The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Welcome to the last session before the final rally. So the good news is there is a PowerPoint. The bad news is we're not allowed to show it because it's hugely expensive to do the audiovisual stuff with the hotel, and we can't do it on our own because that would violate union rules. So I did print out some of the slides from the PowerPoint so you can follow along. I hate to listen to talks that have statistics in them or have quotes, and so I try to include some of those with you. You can read it from sort of left to right. The great thing about this topic for me is I get to speak about a period of working class revolt from below that I actually lived through. I'm sure that's one of the reasons why the Socialism 17 Organizing Committee assigned this talk to me. Give it to Bradshaw, he's old enough to remember what happened. Now, I don't want to judge any books by the cover, but I do see some sort of older books in the room, so perhaps they've also have some experiences from that period that they can share with us. Now, when talking or writing about struggles from other areas, it can be difficult sometimes to go through historical records and writings and really try to gain an understanding of what it's like to be a worker in a period very different from today. So I'm going to try to convey a sense of that period. You'll see in slide number 2. Hopefully you'll gain some important insights and understanding in the period, such as why we all wore bell-bottom jeans, how we could wear platform shoes when we're in the streets fighting the Nazis, why our music was so great, and equally important, why the working class movement exploded with such force, vitality, and creativity. So you may be pleased to learn that I have supplemented my memories with some research. In particular, my presentation draws heavily in the book Rebel Rank and File, Labor Militancy from Below, which is written in large part by members and supporters of the IS, International Socialist Political Tradition. In the end, I'm going to highlight some of my differences with their interpretation of the events and of the period. Now, what are called the long 70s was an extraordinary period in the United States history of working class revolt and upsurge from below. For a decade and a half, the U.S. was gripped by a working class upheaval that encompassed the big manufacturing unions, including auto workers, steel workers, mine workers, rubber, construction, electrical workers. But equally important, the ferment and the upsurge involved big sections of the working class that had been untouched by the previous labor upsurge of the 1930s. This included farm workers, professionals, teachers, and public sector workers. This period was characterized by waves of wildcat strikes in the 1960s and 1980s. For those of you not familiar with the term, wildcat strike means an unofficial strike, often illegal. Wildcat strikes became common, and at the same time, official or legal strikes reached historic levels in terms of absolute numbers. This period also produced the largest political strike in modern U.S. history. It's a period that was characterized by rank-and-file rejection of contracts, the ouster from office of longtime union officials, and perhaps most importantly, the emergence of rank-and-file organizations and caucuses in union after union at both the local and the national level. Now, underlying and really driving this rebellion was a visceral and militant reaction to the pace, methods, and conditions of work in the workplace. Page two, slide number one. But really, it was at the point of production where speed up and pressure really reached intolerable conditions. It's a period in which union leaders were at best insensitive to the conditions their members were experiencing in factories, offices, and hospitals. And instead of leading the fight, union officials did their best to ignore, sabotage, and repress the movement. Union officials were locked in this ideology of business unionism and defense of a system that was becoming intolerable to increasing numbers of their members. Workers found themselves with little choice but to take matters into their own hand. This meant the struggles of the time were often as much against the labor officials as they were against the boss. The labor upsurges of the 60s and 70s were profoundly influenced and in turn help influence the great social movements that really shaped that era. This is especially true of the black movement for civil rights. When the civil rights movement moved north and gave rise to urban rebellions and black power, it had a powerful influence on rank and file workers, particularly black workers in factories, offices, and hospitals, who in turn would become leaders of these revolts. Black, Latino, and Asian workers built their own organizations, and working class feminism burst on the scene as a new and creative force. Latino workers, women workers, rank and file gay workers, returning GIs, workers with disabilities, and so many more workers imitated the black struggle with a newfound sense of rights, mass mobilization, and direct action. Now, there's so much packed into these 15 years, 1965 to 1980, it can make it exciting and difficult to talk about. The breadth and the depth of the struggle makes it difficult to do justice to individual elements, such as Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, known as DRUM, Miners for Democracy, the Farm Workers Union, and so on. At Socialism, we often devote a whole session to one of these topics. In fact, down the hall, you'll find a session going on now by Curry on the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement. So to capture all these elements means the talk is going to be at a somewhat higher level. Now notice what I did here, is I made myself immune to your criticism and your challenges. So when you get up in the discussion, you go, but you didn't really cover this. I could just say, yes, but comrade, I wasn't able to get that due to time. But seriously, it is a very rich period. Now what set the working class on this journey of rebellion was at its root a qualitative shift in the function of the U.S. economy and how the employees responded to that, and then the way in which the union officials responded to both. For the first time since the Great Depression, the U.S. hit a series of recessions. In an attempt to restore profitability, employers unleashed an offensive that was aimed to reduce cost. And this has ushered in profound changes to our economy that are still unfolding today, as the 2016 election showed us. Now, although the labor upsurge of the 60s and 70s was not a creation of the left contributed in important ways. And despite our small size, the International Socialist and the International Socialist Organization did play important roles. So you'll see on page 2, slide 4, the outline is first we're going to look at the origins and forces that drove the rebellion, including demographic shifts in the workforce. We're going to look at the ways the rebellion played out. And then finally, we're going to look at some of the weaknesses of the rebellion and suggest some of the reasons for those weaknesses and limitations, and end by looking at what the lessons we can draw from this exceptional period of working class struggle. So let's look at the origin. Let me set the stage for the rebellion by looking at the forces that gave rise to it. I think understanding the forces that drove the rebellion also help us later to understand the limitations of the upsurge and why, despite its power and its energy, the rebellion did not lead to a long-term transformation of the American labor movement. So I'm going to cover three elements that I think will help us understand the rebellion: business unionism, changes in the post-war economy, and demographic shifts in the workforce. Now, we in the ISO use the term business unionism to describe the ideology and practice of the American trade unionism. In history books and academia, it's sometimes referred to as pure and simple unionism or bread and butter unionism. But business unionism was forged in a long and bitter battle within the labor movement against socialists. Now, a core tenet of business unionism is a rejection of socialist class ideas and really a rejection of any major social transformation. As one of the founders of business unionism famously told a Senate committee back in 1883, we have no ultimate ends. We are going from day to day. We are fighting only for immediate objects. We are practical men. And by men, he literally meant men. Another bedrock of business unionism is the idea that the union is a business and should be run by one. Dave Beck, an early president of the Teamsters, proclaimed, "Unions are big business." And the logical conclusion of this is that unions should function like business and be run on the same principles as a large business or corporation. Another idea that became central to the practice of business unionism was the belief that there's some community or a common interest between employers and capital, between workers and capital. Now, one consequence of not having bigger ideas than winning higher wages or improving your working conditions is that business unionism often reflected the prejudice and divisions in the working class. Capitalism creates competition between workers to obtain and keep jobs and for other resources. So one way that you could win higher wages is to limit competition. You could exclude blacks, women, immigrants, unskilled workers. And this was a narrow, pragmatic route taken by the early business union leaders, who often embraced and espoused really some of the worst racism, misogyny, and xenophobia. And finally, the alliance with the Democratic Party is a logical extension of business unionism into the political sphere. The lack of ultimate or long-range goals, the embracement of a capitalist system, maybe with some minor modifications, and the self-importance that comes from associating with those in power. All these features of business unionism fit well with the idea of an alliance with the capitalist party most willing or most open to compromise. Now, business unionism faced major challenges during the labor upsurge in the 1930s and the resurgence of the left. Business unionism managed to survive in part by the suppression of the left that began during the war and escalated dramatically with the start of the Cold War. Communists, socialists, anarchists, radicals, really of any kind of any stripe were harassed, expelled, and eliminated from the labor movement. But it wasn't simply the purging of Red members, McCarthyism and Cold War ideology was imported into the unions. Now let's look at changes in the economy. So by the late 1950s, business unions seemed to be able to deliver the goods, the bread and the butter. Now the grand bargain that was struck by business unionism in the post-war period was the promise that they could deliver regular improvements in the standards for its members. And they planned to do this by not just ensuring profits for the employers, but rising profits. And they were going to do this in large part by ensuring rising productivity. Now this meant agreeing to technological changes, automation, speed up, really surrendering control of the shop floor to management, and also undermining the capacity of the rank and file to battle management at the point of production. And underlying this whole sort of edifice was this model of permanent growth. The problem is that even at the peak of prosperity, the American economy was plagued by contradictions. Although the rate of profit on average was high, there was still this underlying volatility. At the end of the 50s, for the first time since the Great Depression, the U.S. economy hit a serious downturn. Two recessions in quick succession led to a period of stagnation. Now, given the grand bargain made by union officials, they were committed to helping the corporations restore their profitability. All they could do was agree to wage restraint and relinquish more control of the shop floor. This new economic reality revealed a labor leadership that was all too willing to make concessions to restore the financial health of the corporations, and it led to a crescendo of concessions across industries. It was this inability and this unwillingness of an entrenched bureaucracy to mount an effective response to the escalating employers' offensive that provoked this rebellion by the rank and file. Faced with a sudden slowdown and a profound deterioration in working conditions, the rank and file had to organize for their own defense. Now, due to the legacy of business unionism, suppression of the left, the stifling of solidarity, militants who were trying to resist really lacked the connections of solidarity beyond the workplace. So they fell back on the informal work groups that grew naturally and directly out of workers' cooperation at the point of production. And when informal groups became part of informal networks, they could vote down unacceptable contracts, they could launch quickie strikes, they could even oust entrenched union officials. And when conditions on the job really drove these informal groups to repeated actions, it could create a movement. One of a partial antidote to this sort of ossified business unionism was provided by demographic shifts in the workforce. A new generation of workers were entering the workforce, and they came with a new set of attitudes. But perhaps the most important change in the workforce was the mass entry of women and African Americans into the nation's private industries and the emerging public sector. In the years following World War II, 4 million African Americans moved north, really doubling the proportion of the black population in the Northeast and the Midwest. Big industrial cities like Detroit, Cleveland, Flint, Gary were becoming or became majority black cities. A large number of African Americans went to work in auto and steel. Of the 9 million African Americans in the civilian workforce, one third were employed in basic industry. GM and Chrysler's workforce was 25% African American. Ford was higher at 34%. And everywhere they went into northern industry, black workers were met with discrimination and racism. Now the second big change in the composition of the workforce was a large-scale entry of women, particularly married women. In 1950, women made up only 29% of the paid workforce. By 1970, it increased to 38%. And married women made up two-thirds of that increase. So between 1960 and 1974, 1.3 million women joined unions. In 1960, women were only 18% of union membership. By 1980, it was at 30%. And women poured into new public sector unions like AFSCME and the teachers' unions, and they also made inroads into basic industry. African Americans and women didn't suffer silently the indignities of racism and sexism they found inside the unions. They built their own caucuses and their organizations. And really, it was the massive entrance of women and African Americans into the workforce starting in the 50s that really helped shape the working class upsurge in the 1960s and 70s. This was partly by the mere presence of workers that had a different work and union experience. But second was by their involvement in the major social movements of the era. The existence of the civil rights, black power, and women's movement gave the labor upsurge as a whole a broader political consciousness than it would have otherwise had. Kim Moody and rebel rank and file goes so far as to say it would be hard to imagine the rank and file upsurge of the 60s and 70s without the migration of African Americans to the industrial north and the large-scale entrance of women into paid work. Their social movements really shaped the consciousness of the entire upsurge. So let's look at what the rebellion looked like. Now, the early signs of rebellion and the collective dissatisfaction of the rank and file with their union leadership began to show up in the rising number of contract rejections. Before 1962, contract rejections were so rare the government didn't even bother to track them. As the number of rejections rose steadily through the 60s and into the 70s, the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service began collecting data on their numbers. Now, there's one important caveat. The agency only collects data on contract rejections when they were actually physically at the bargaining table and recorded that rejection. So the real numbers are underreported. But if you look on page 3, slide 1, you're going to see the number of rejections rose steadily. In 1964, the first year that numbers were available, 8.7% of all negotiated contracts were rejected by the rank and file. By 65, it's climbed to 10%, and you'll see by 1967, it's jumped to 14.2%. Now, most of the time, the workers who rejected their union negotiated contracts won more money in the next settlement. If you look on page 3, slide 2, you'll see a quote by a federal mediator, Ron Houghton, who told Business Week, "Our society rewards those that put pressure on. The rank and file have learned that usually when they reject a contract, the company offers something better." But if the officials repeatedly bring you crappy contracts, what do you do? Well, that comes a little bit later, but throw them out, right. So as the labor upsurge began to take shape and really gather momentum, union members inevitably sought to replace the officials they believed had failed to represent them. In 1966, you'll see this quote on page 3, slide 3, Business Week would write that overturning of top officials reflected, quote, "a growing restiveness that is threatening the former invulnerability of union leaders. Only a few years ago, union leaders were rarely challenged at elections. Most clung to office as long as they lived or were able to serve or thought they were able. Some still do, but that is true in fewer and fewer unions." Now, those who were tossed out really reflected a catalog of officials who were seen as too close or too understanding to management. And you'll see on page 3, slide 4, a list of some of the unions where the top officers were deposed. Not all of them came from electoral defeats. Some, when faced with a challenger, where they knew they were going to lose, they would retire early to spend more time with their family, or simply withdraw from running for re-election. The problem is the opposition typically emanated from the ranks of the union's secondary leaders, who themselves were facing mounting pressure from an increasingly restive rank and file. So while the opposition candidate reflected rank and file dissatisfaction and depended on rank and file votes, they themselves were not part of this grassroots rebellion. The new leaders, without exception, accepted no less than their predecessor the company's right to manage and control the shop floor, and that meant that they rarely, if ever, addressed the worsening conditions that were the overriding concern of the membership. This meant, too, that they were often faced more vigorous opposition themselves from below. Now let's turn to wildcat strikes. Rejecting contracts and turning out labor officials was not enough to stop the employer's offensive. The rank and file were obliged to mount their own defense, so they turned to direct action. The early rebellion was, above all, a wildcat strike movement. The rise in the number and the scope of wildcat strikes is perhaps the most dramatic expression of the rank and file explosion. Now, wildcat strikes are generally brief. They're usually motivated by on-the-job grievances as opposed to wages and benefits. They often take place during the life of the contract. What makes them so threatening is that they bypass the formal grievance procedure, they ignore union rules, they're usually done in opposition to union officials, they defy the contract, they break the employer's rules and regulations. So at their core, wildcat strikes reject management's unrestricted right to control the production process, and they deny the authority of the union officials to speak for the ranks. Not surprisingly, they're usually illegal. That's why wildcat strikes are often the most threatening challenge to the established system of labor relations. Now, no official record exists of wildcat strikes. There is, however, a fairly reliable surrogate for the wildcat strikes. Strikes recorded by the Bureau of Labor Statistics as lasting 3 days or less and taking place during the life of the contract constitutes a pretty good proxy for wildcat strikes. And you'll look on page 4, slide 1, from the early 60s to the mid-70s, the number of wildcat strikes taking place each year more than doubled, from 600 a year to 1,400 a year. In 1972, for example, there were more than 1,000 strikes among mine workers, 90% of which were unofficial wildcat strikes. The same year, half of all strikes by construction workers and a third of all strikes by electrical workers were wildcat strikes. And they came to represent a growing proportion of all strikes. By 72, 73, 75, and 76, wildcat strikes made up fully one-fourth of all strikes. Now, wildcat strikes usually involved only one plant or one group of workers, but several of the bigger ones involved tens of thousands of workers. Teamsters in 1970, 200,000 workers. Postal workers in 1970, I think 220,000. And telephone workers in 1971. Now, wildcat strikes are the most threatening, but they're just part of a much larger strike wave. Strike activity, on page 5, you'll see slides 1 and 2. I see that the reproduction makes them unreadable. My apologies for that. It's not fake news. I'll tell you what it really says. But strike activity had been declining since the 1950s and really reached a post-war low in 1963. But from that point on, the number of strikes, the number of days lost to strikes, the proportion of time lost to strikes all rose dramatically and steadily. And to understand why, think of a pressure cooker. Now, I know we're in the 21st century, and we're not supposed to use steam analogies anymore, but Joel used it in his talk. And we used pressure cookers in the 70s to cook with, so I think I'm free to use that analogy. But if there's a scientist comrade in the room who wants to give me a new technology or nanotechnology analogy, I'm open to it. So just at the point when workers are stepping up their efforts to address speed up and working conditions and make up lost ground and wages, corporate profits start to fall. Between 65 and 69, manufacturing profits fell by a third, primarily due to overcapacity and foreign competition. So you have this volatile mix of speed up and wage suppression, and then you add in the sudden acceleration of inflation in the middle of the decade. If you look on page 6, slide number 1, one of the remarkable features about the post-war period was price stability. So you'll see in the years between 60 and 65, inflation averaged about 1.2%. By 65, it's starting to climb. By 1967, it's doubled to 3.1%. And in 1970, which was a recession year, it had jumped to 5.7%. So protection of living standards against erosion by inflation now became a top priority for workers. Business Week, as you see on slide 2 on page 6, you'll see this quote, I love it, by Business Week. The union member in September 1966 is militant, confident, and loaded for bear. He intends to press for substantial wage increases as a matter of justice to match booming profits and as a matter of need to compensate for rising living costs. He is remarkably well informed about both phenomena. So, back to the pressure cooker analogy. An increasingly well-organized rank and file is upping the pressure on officials. Neither the workers nor the employers want to back down and have very little room to move. So tensions began to rise and it became much more difficult to reach an agreement at the bargaining table. One more quote from Fortune magazine in 1969. Just as the companies begin to prepare for an expected slowing in the economy and an expected crunch on profits, they are met with wage demands that are rocking upward with inflation. Such a combination of events is unusual and dangerous. Now, Fortune's fears were fully borne out in the following year. In 1970, 66 million workdays were lost due to 5,716 strikes, the most ever. One in six union members were on strike that year. And if you look on slide 5 on page 6, you'll see just a list of some of those, but the list could go on and on. These are strikes involving 10,000 or more workers. If you look on the next slide, you'll see 5 of the most dramatic and national strikes, and you'll see the numbers of workers were involved. Now, the problem is the strikes in 1970 really turned out to represent the crest of a decade-long strike wave, and what, in hindsight, it was a culmination of rank-and-file militancy of the late 1960s. Control of the union machinery and control of the bargaining process by top officials really allowed the international unions to ignore the demands of the rank and file. And the only effective way really to get beyond that control and the domination of officials was to build organizations based on the rank and file. And we need to remember this is nothing new in the American labor movement. Rank and file movements in American unions can be traced back to the years following World War I. The explosion of labor militancy and radicalism during the First World War, coupled with high levels of dissatisfaction with business unionism, led to opposition groups being formed in many unions. They often took the form of rank and file caucuses, often led by left-wingers who headed much broader formations of less politicized workers. Now, in virtually every major union in the 60s and 70s, militants were drawing similar conclusions about the need for their own organization. These formations were often led by political radicals from socialist groups of one kind or another, who launched some type of rank and file organization that challenged both the employers and the union officials. I'm just going to talk about three of the bigger ones. The most impressive was probably Miners for Democracy, which was formed in 1970 shortly after the assassination of opposition candidate Jack Yablonsky and his family. Yablonsky's movement had grown out of the Black Lung Strike in February of 1969, where 45,000 West Virginia coal miners refused to mine coal until the legislature passed a pension law that would compensate miners for black lung disease. It's the largest political strike in modern U.S. history. The Miners for Democracy were the only rank-and-file group in the 70s to win control of their national union. They democratized the union, but they really didn't have a vision beyond business unionism. That meant they had no effective response to the employer's offensive, with its technological changes, closing of pits, and cuts in health and safety. The Teamsters Union also produced a number of rank-and-file newsletters and a succession of rank-and-file organizations, including Teamsters for a Democratic Union. In 1973, Teamster President Frank Fitzsimmons, who had replaced Jimmy Hoffa, agreed to a crappy deal under pressure from his friend and golf buddy, Richard Nixon. So in 1975, a group of 35 rank-and-file Teamsters, mostly veterans of the big 1970 Teamster Wildcat, met the plan for the expiration of the Master Freight Agreement in 1976. The group included leading Teamster ISO militants, and they took on the name Teamsters for a Democratic Contract. Teamsters for a Decent Contract was allied with a sister rank-and-file opposition group in UPS called Upsurge. Again, Teamster ISO militants played a large and formative role in the creation of Upsurge. We distributed thousands of flyers demanding cost of living allowances, wages, pensions, a shorter two-year contract, restoration of the right to strike over grievances. Everyone in Detroit IS was given flyers. We saturated every truck stop, every rest area, every Teamster barn, every truck pull-off in southern Michigan, and branches around the country did similar. This pressure from the rank and file did force Fitzsimmons to call national strikes in both the Master Freight Agreement and at UPS, and both official strikes were followed by brief localized wildcats. And this success led Teamsters for Democratic Contract to form a more permanent organization, Teamsters for a Democratic Union, which is still in existence today. Now, black workers also played leading roles in several rank-and-file groups, particularly those in auto and steel. The best known was the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, or DRUM. It was followed by other revolutionary union movements formed by black workers in factories across Detroit. Similar formations emerged in New Jersey and in California. Now, unlike Miners for Democracy and Teamsters for Democratic Union, the black caucuses saw themselves as politically radical, as part of a broader black liberation movement, and in some sense, part of an international revolution. Now, I'm not going to go too much into DRUM. Curry is actually giving a talk on DRUM, as I said, down the hall. But DRUM had a critique of both bureaucracy and racism. Their theory was that both management and the union was using racism to divide and control the workforce. The black revolutionary union movements and similar caucuses focused on workplace issues, and they put forward political demands, and they led wildcat strikes, and they published revolutionary manifestos, and they linked their struggle to the community. Political radicals played key roles in the caucus and at one point tried to pull these groups together under the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. Now, these are just some of the more high-profile national rank-and-file groups. There were smaller, localized groups that sprung up in plants, offices, hospitals, government offices, all across the country. These groups were very different, as each workplace had its own culture, its own issues. Each industry has sort of its own bargaining and strike tempo. But the commonality of these groups was that they originated in the workplace, they came together in an effort to mobilize beyond the usual activist layer, and they combined on-the-job struggle with union political activity in varying combinations. Now, I've sort of broken into pieces of contract rejections, ousting officials, wildcat strikes. I wanted to do that as opposed to doing a chronology, which I think is much harder to follow. But you have to remember, to really get a flavor of the time, these were all happening at the same time. And the background, you've got, you know, 63, the March on Washington, 64, you've got the riots in Philadelphia, Rochester, Harlem. You got the farm workers union starting to organize. You got the great boycott. You got just imagine the 60s and 70s social movements as the background of this. The March on Washington in 67, the Democratic Convention, the assassination of King. I mean, 50 years ago, in 1967, there were 150 urban rebellions alone in that year. More in 1968 after King was assassinated. So I just want to sort of paint that picture as we sort of look at evaluating the effect of the rank and file upsurge. Because at the end of the day, the rank and file movements of the 60s and 70s really failed to transform the unions and the broader labor movement. So what happened to the rank and file rebellion? Why is there so little residue or lasting impact from this enormous upsurge? Now, the first blow to the rebellion was the recession of 74 and 75, which at that time was the deepest since the 1930s. Unemployment jumped, almost doubling, and reaching the highest levels in the post-war period. Unemployment for factory workers more than doubled to almost 14%. To win wage gains, to improve your working conditions, or get better benefits in this new environment, really would have required a far more massive movement than the rank and file upsurge. Specifically, it would have required a decisive break with business unionism, akin to the 1930s rebellion. Now, the shock of the 74 recession didn't put a complete end to the upheaval. Until the close of the decade, the number of strikes remained higher than they had throughout the 60s. Militancy declined in some industries like auto and the post office, but carried on in other ones like trucking and the public sector. Public workers, especially teachers, remained strike prone throughout the 70s. The miners remained extraordinarily active with dozens of wildcat strikes, an official 110-day strike starting in 1977, in which they defied President Carter's invoking of the Taft-Hartley Act, ordering them back to work. They refused. The upsurge did finally collapse with a bang, or rather two bangs, and they came in the form of two major government assaults on the labor movement. The Chrysler bailout in 1979, which really opened the floodgates of concessionary bargaining, and two, Ronald Reagan's firing of the striking professional air traffic controllers and decertifying the union in 1981. Between 79 and 81, there was a 50% drop-off in the number of strikes. In the same period, union organizing in the private sector almost collapsed. The number of government-run elections for union representation dropped from nearly 8,000 in 1980 to half of that in 81. Union membership dropped by 2 million between 79 and 83 and has not recovered since then. Now, the end of the rebellion is often attributed to the second recession of 1882, and that recession certainly played a role. But it can't be the only or the major factor to explain the collapse of the rank and file rebellion. That's because the far deeper recession of 74 and 75 failed to have the same effect. In that recession, strikes held up, new organizing barely decreased, and union membership actually grew. So I think we have to look elsewhere for more and better answers. These are some of what I feel are the factors at play. You may have your own hypothesis, or we can talk about their relative importance. But first is a sustained economic crisis, even after the recession of 1982. It was manifested in reduced profit rates and intensifying international competition. This led to a profound restructuring in industries such as auto and steel. Number two, capital got organized, symbolized by the emergence of the Business Roundtable in the 1970s. One journalist called the Business Roundtable a capitalist vanguard formation that symbolized the political rearmament of the business community. And business resistance to new organizing grew even fiercer, leading to a total collapse in new organizing. There was a systematic attack and attempt to roll back the gains of the 60s and 70s social movements, such as affirmative action, reproductive rights, and environmental protections. Third, I would say, there was a concurrent demise of the black movement. Many of the rank and file initiatives were inspired by the example of the black movement, But by the early 1970s, as the rank and file movements were really facing their biggest challenges, virtually all wings of the black freedom movement were in sharp decline, facing enormous repression and isolation. Rank and file rebellions were thus deprived of one of their sources of dynamism. And the obverse side of weakening the black movement was the white backlash, which was gathering momentum across the industrial heartland. But fourth, I'd say it's really a failure to transcend the framework of business unionism. For all the oppositional character and independence of action, the rank and file rebellions of the time remained prisoners of business unionism, the same institutions they sought to change. And they reflected the limitations most dramatically in the fragmentation. There were massive strike waves in multiple industries leading to rank and file organizations. But the leading organizations of the time, Miners for Democracy, Teamsters for Democratic Union, Steelworkers Fight Back, did not make a serious attempt to relate to one another. There was a virtual absence of cross-union or cross-fertilization between these groups. Almost as a given, the activists and leaders of these rank-and-file movements accepted the silos and the isolation that went along with business unionism. The private welfare state created by union contracts further divided workers by keeping their eyes focused primarily on the employer, not on the state, which was the focus of the other movements at the time. So as a result, the various movements and forces of the rebellion really never gelled into a single powerful movement like the civil rights, the anti-war movement. We had a black liberation movement, we had a women's liberation movement, a gay liberation movement, but there was no workers' liberation movement. Related to that, and I would say number five, is there was a lack of a radical core in an organized leftist of the type that played a major role in the 1920s and 30s, sort of this indispensable left grassroots leadership on the shop floor. So the rebellion lacked both a workers' liberation movement and a centralizing left or socialist organization, political tendency, or institutions that could really concentrate and magnify the activity of these disparate rank and file groups. Now, socialists and radicals did play important roles in some rank-and-file organizations like Teamsters and auto workers and steel workers, but our numbers were few, and none of the organizations were strong enough to provide leadership on a national scale, with the possible exception of the International Socialist and the Teamsters Union. And finally, I'd say these other factors are hugely important, but really it was a systematic repression and suppression by the labor bureaucracy that killed the rank-and-file upsurge. Rather than nurture this incredible energy that was mobilized by rank and file resistance and channel that power and creativity into a struggle against an employer, labor officials systematically dispersed those. Subduing their own militant base weakened many of labor movement's strongest unions, Teamsters, steelworkers, auto workers. Precisely to the degree that the officials succeeded in wearing down the resistance of the ranks, they wore down the ability of the union as an institution to fight back in the face of increased employer aggression. This left the labor movement unarmed for the economic and political conditions which worsened from the mid-70s, and this in turn, I think, opened the door to 50 years of concession, retreat, and decline for the labor movement. Rank and file movements again and again pointed to the limits of business unionism, but they lacked the power and the vision to transcend it. That can only come from greater organization, greater class consciousness, and a stronger socialist left current in the labor movement.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.